Warning, the following podcast may discuss topics of violence that may not be suitable for all ages. Listener discretion is advised.
Hello and welcome back to Above and Beyond. As always, I'm your host, Philip Kesterson, and tonight is the second installment of the Q&A episode. And I have absolutely nothing for housekeeping, so we're just going to jump right into this. So, the first question that we have tonight is, why aren't World War I Germans treated the same as World War II Germans? Now, the way that I'm interpreting this question is it's being asked, why are World War II Germans called monsters and Nazis and blah 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 blah, and then World War I Germans, they're not treated to that extent. Well, the thing about it is that World War I Germans, that was an entirely different Germany. Like, the German Empire, on the onset of World War I, they didn't have the same ideology that World War II Germans did. Because, see, when you look at World War II, today when you look at World War II, it's really easy to be like, well, here's the clear good guys, here's the clear bad guys. But World War I was tricky. In past episodes, I have gone into detail of the beginning of World War I and how it started. I'm not going to get into that tonight, but what I will say is, at the onset of World War I, you can't really tell where the bad guy was, because there wasn't one. Tensions were brewing so much during the years leading up to World War I that there was just the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand on June 28, 1914. That was just the straw that broke the camel's back. Everybody was pissing off everybody, and something was eventually going to happen. Now, nobody could foresee exactly how extensive that something would have happened, but they all knew that something was eventually going to happen, and that's what happened. Like I said, when he was assassinated, it plunged the world into war. And it was basically just, you were either on this side or you were either on this side. Now, fast forward almost 20 years to World War II, and it's different. Because World War I Germans were not Nazis. That is the thing. I hear this in senior level college courses. I hear people refer to World War I era Germans as Nazis. And that is just incorrect. World War I ended in 1918, and the Nazi Party wasn't founded until, I think, 1920. I know it was the 20s. I want to say it was 1920. You know, September 1st, 1939, when Germany invaded Poland and pretty much started World War II, they had a clear plan. They were hell-bent on world domination in World War II, but in World War I, it was basically just shit hit the fan. There wasn't really clear objectives other than we felt we were attacked, so we're going to attack. Same with the Allies. Or they were just like, we felt we were attacked, so we're going to attack. But in World War II, the Germans were like, hi, yeah, we're going to take all of this, and if you get in our way, we're going to beat the living crap out of you. And that's how it was. But even when you like start to really look into World War II, it's a little bit more unclear, because there's two types of Germans who fought in the German army World War II. You had the Wehrmacht, the regular German army, and then you had the Waffen-SS. Now, the Waffen-SS was Hitler's main, like, troops. They were the ones that they orchestrated most of the Holocaust. They were the ones that were taking part in most of the mass shootings. They were the ones watching the concentration camps, stuff like that. But the Wehrmacht, a lot of them, a majority of them, were just regular soldiers who were fighting for their country. Now, I'm not excusing anything that the Germans did during World War II, and I'm definitely not condoning, like, the Holocaust or anything like that, but the average Wehrmacht soldier had no idea what was going on, and this is evident in when the war was over, a lot of German POWs were rounded up and forced to watch hours and hours of footage from concentration camps, and a lot of them were really affected by this because they didn't know what was happening. Now, of course, there were officers in the Wehrmacht who participated in a lot of the mass killings and stuff like that, but at least for my American listeners, I can't think of a comparison on an international scale, but at least for my American listeners, saying that every single soldier in the Wehrmacht were Jew-hating monsters is the equivalent of saying that every single soldier that fought for the Confederacy is a slave-owning racist. It's just not true. The fact of the matter is, not every Confederate had slaves, not every Confederate was fighting to preserve slavery, in the same way that not every Wehrmacht soldier was fighting specifically because they hated Jews or that they wanted to get rid of Jews. A lot of them were just fighting for their country. The waters are just extremely muddy in this situation. I said it a minute ago and I'll say it again. World War One, there's no clear bad guy. That's why World War One Germans are not treated like they were in World War Two, because the ones that got just absolutely bent over the barrel the most in World War One, and I hate thinking about it in the long term, because it's like, it's really sad, is like, there were a lot of German Jews who fought for Germany during World War One, and on the onset of World War Two, they thought, well, we fought for the fatherland once, nothing's gonna happen to us, and then they themselves became victims of the Holocaust. Like, that is just, that level of betrayal is unreal. And I hate that for them. I hate that this all happened. But it happened, and there's really nothing we can do to change it. Now, going to World War II, like I said, there's a very clear bad guy. Very, very clear bad guy. Germans bad. Germans bad. Bad Germany. Go to your room. Like, they were the bad guys. They were orchestrating mass killings. They were gassing people. They were throwing people in camps. And they were committing all these atrocities. So, like, all the bad opinions that, or not necessarily opinions, all the bad things that people say about Germans in World War II, it's definitely founded. It's well-founded. Because, like I said, they were the bad guys. But I also think it stems from the end of World War I. Like, at the Treaty of Versailles, they kind of screwed Germany. And I'm not saying that, like, in a bad way, but they screwed Germany. Like, you can't really say who started World War I. But at the end of World War I, everybody was like, it was Germany. But I mean, like, it was a Serbian assassin who shot the Archduke of Austria-Hungary. And everybody's like, you know what, Germany, this is all your fault. You're going to front the bill. And then Germany had to pay a piss ton of reparations for World War I. But I hope that answered the question. I know that was very confusing, but I hope that answered the question. Germans in World War II were nowhere near the same Germans that were in World War I, and that's why there's a big difference there. So our next question was submitted by Mia Turner from New Zealand. So Mia, if you're listening, hi. And the question is, what's your favorite little-known war? And I really enjoy this question. This is going to be a short one because, like I said in the last episode, I'm not really doing research leading up to this episode, so what I'm talking about is just simply the knowledge that I have. I can think, when I read this question, there was one war in particular that popped in my head, and that is the War of the Oaken Bucket. Now, this was a war that, at least legend says, this is a war that was started in the 14th century over a bucket. And it was fought in northern Italy, I believe, northern Italy, it was fought in Italy, I know for a fact it was fought in Italy, and it was between two, like, warring nations. I think it was, like, Medina in another country, I cannot think of it, started with a B, and basically some Medina soldiers were moving through this other part of Italy, and there was a well or a bucket in a well, and they were like, I'm going to take this as a trophy. And then they took it. And then when the place that they were at, when they found out about it, they were like, where's our bucket? I want our bucket back. And then boom, you had a war. And it was like, it was ridiculous. I can't remember the exact numbers, but I know like a good amount of people died in this. Like it was in the thousands maybe that people died from this over a bucket. And it's like, a lot of people kick the bucket over stealing a bucket. You know what I mean? It's funny to me. I guess, you know, most people know about this other one I'm going to talk about, but it's an honorable mention because I think it'd be bad of me not to answer. Most people's favorite weird war, and Yeah, admittedly, it is one of my favorites just because it's ridiculous. Most people know about the Great Emu War of 1932. Basically, if you don't know what that was, this was fought in Australia in 1932. And basically, the emu population, if you don't know what an emu is, think of a really pissed off ostrich all the time. That's basically what an emu is. Now, the emu population was just getting very, very large in Australia, and they were, like, destroying crops and stuff for farmers, and the farmers kept pleading, like, we have to do something about this. So there was a small force of soldiers who were sent out to just, they were literally sent out with machine guns to just get rid of these emus. And they lost. Like, technically the emus won. Like, they wouldn't stop coming, and they wouldn't, like, die, and they ended up winning, and the Australian government was just eventually like, we cannot do this anymore. I think it was only like 2-3 months long, but yeah, the Australian government was just like, this is ridiculous, we're not doing this anymore, sorry not sorry. Okay, so this next question, good Lord, I love this next question. This is absolutely my favorite question I've been asked, because it is just, it's very out there, but I love it. The question is, who would win, the Roman army at the height of their power versus the army of Mordor? And this was submitted by Elizabeth from England. Now, before I go any further, I just want to say, I know for a fact that this question was not submitted by the Queen of England, but it is hilarious of me to think, because this woman's name is Elizabeth from England, which, hi, by the way, welcome to the show. It's hilarious to me to think that Elizabeth from England, Queen Elizabeth from England, is wanting to know who would win between the Roman army and the army of Mordor. So we're going to get into it. Now, this is like, the reason I love this question is it's two of my favorite things. The Roman Empire is my favorite point of history, and then Lord of the Rings is, like, my favorite storyline. So, that's why I love it. Like, this is gonna be good. So, Rome at the height of their power, like, first of all, the numbers alone are, like, very skewed. Because Rome at the height of their power, this is around 117 AD, they would have had about 400,000 soldiers, like, under their operation. And the Army of Mordor, off the top of my head, I can think of the army that amassed at Pelennor Fields in Return of the King for that last big battle. And I think the number for that was around like 250,000-300,000, somewhere in that range. So like already the numbers are like in favor of the Romans. Like the Romans have more. And the Romans are elite fighting force, so already they have the advantage. But, like, I'm going to get into why one side, the technicals of both sides. So, Roman army adapted fast. Like, when these war elephants, so when Hannibal marched across the Alps with war elephants, and they first fought in Rome, I think during the Punic Wars, like, a lot of these Romans had no idea what an elephant was. So, when this giant horned horse starts charging at you, at first, yeah, they were most likely scared, but they adapted very quick, and they knew what to do. Like, I have never been able to definitively prove this, but I've always heard and always read places that one of the countermeasures that Romans had for war elephants was taking hogs, covering them in oil, lighting them on fire, and then sending them towards the elephants, because the elephants would get scared, and then they would turn around and run. And they would, like, go through their own men. So, it's stupid of me to think. Now, of course, time out. The war elephants in Lord of the Rings, I cannot, off the top of my head, remember the name of the dudes who had the war elephants. But those were some big boys. Like, those were not your normal size elephants. These were, like, elephants on steroids. And I still think the Romans could have, like, figured out what to do with them. Like, when the initial, not even just the war of the elephants, when, like, the initial shock of seeing these orcs would have gone on, they probably just thought that they were some Germanic tribe when they see them, because it's basically, if you lived any time during the Roman Empire, you were either a Roman or you were a barbarian. There was no in between. Going back to the war elephants, the Rohirrim cavalry, what was that, like, what, like 6,000 guys? They routed the war elephants at Pelennor Fields, first of all. So, like, if 6,000 scattered Rohirrim cavalry can turn the war elephants, then it's completely plausible that the greatest army that's ever existed, in my opinion, their cavalry could have easily done the same thing. Plus, I don't know if you guys know this, but the Romans don't necessarily give a shit if they lose men in battle. I mean, like, they do, but they don't. What I mean by that is, like, at the Battle of Cannae, the Romans lost 70,000 guys in one day at this battle. That's almost the same amount as Americans that died during the entire Vietnam War. This was one day in Roman history that all this happened. And, like, at the time, the Roman Empire, the population was around, like, I don't know, it was in, like, the hundreds of thousands. So this was a very, very large chunk of people that died. And basically, when they lost it, they were, like, their enemy, I cannot think of who they were fighting. I want to say it was Hannibal. I'm pretty sure it was Hannibal. I hate that I'm forgetting. I'm gonna admit that. Their enemies were like, we just did this big blow to you. You're gonna have to, like, submit, right? And the Romans were like, we will literally see you tomorrow, and let me catch you outside, I swear to God. Like, that's basically how it was. Now, the army of Mordor, they're inferior in every way. Like, I'm just gonna throw that out there. I mean, you had hobbits in the Lord of the Rings series. You had hobbits stacking bodies of orcs. Like, that should say something. Like, the orc army, they have a lot less morale. Their fighting skills kind of suck. I think the most, off the top of my head, the most organized you ever see an orc army, and it's the Uruk-hai, is at the Battle of Helm's Deep. And when you look at Pelennor Fields, they had some battle lines, but their battle lines were very, very loose. At Helm's Deep, that was a coordinated attack, and it was a good attack. And they even surprised, like, Aragorn and all of them, they still surprised them by blowing up the wall, because nobody expected that to happen. Like, the Uruk-hai, that's like the elite fighting force, basically. You know, Roman equipment, Roman shields, Roman gladiuses, that is some top-tier weaponry at the time. And the orcs, they didn't have that. I mean, their swords are cool, I'm not gonna lie to you, but they just did not have that. Now, I think the only thing that would realistically help the orcs is, let's say, in this hypothetical battle between the Romans and the orcs, Sauron is there. But if we're going based off the large amount of army that they had at Pelennor Fields, then you have to remember, and this is something that I think you'll have to take into account, Sauron would not have had the ring at this time point, because Frodo and Sam were still taking it to Mordor. So Sauron would not have had the ring at this point, so you cannot let him have it for this battle. Does that make sense? I think that's fair. I believe that's fair. Judges, is that fair? I don't have judges, no one answered, but I think it's fair. So I think that would have raised the morale of the orcs a little bit, but overall, I still think it would have done much. I think the best thing that the orcs would have had is they would have had to shatter the Roman line in the opening engagement. Because if they caught the Romans by surprise, then they probably could have done it. Like, at the Battle of Tuatha Berg Forest, that was three Roman legions that got caught in the open by Germanic tribes and slaughtered. They got absolutely slaughtered. It is one of the worst days, excluding the Battle of Cannae, because the Battle of Cannae was, like, their largest loss. But the Battle of Tuatha Berg Forest, that was, like, an embarrassment to the Roman Empire. It shows that a lesser army can shatter this great army if they catch them by surprise. So if the orcs catch the Romans by surprise and then shatter them, they could do it. I think they could do it. That being said, Romans win this battle all day long, every day. I don't think, I would love to have seen, like, a deadliest warrior version of this. Like, there is no outcome I could think where the orcs actually win this, except for, like I said, if they break them in that opening engagement. Okay, so, moving on to the next question. This is a good question, too. It's, did old armies experience PTSD? Now, the base answer is yes. Yes, all soldiers will experience some form of PTSD. it, you know, when you say old soldiers or old armies, I'm going to throw this back. I'm going to say World War One and back, like back to the beginning of time. So World War One, PTSD didn't have an official name at this point. And just for the record, if you don't know what PTSD is, it's post-traumatic stress disorder. It's basically like, you don't even have to be a soldier to do this. Like if you were in a car accident or if you were assaulted in some way, you can get PTSD from that. You don't have to just be a soldier to get PTSD. But PTSD wasn't always officially a thing. Like in World War One, it was called shell shock. During like the American Civil War, there wasn't really a name for it, but there were some soldiers who were discharged. Like for instance, Rufus Dawes, he was a commanding officer for the 6th Wisconsin, 7th Wisconsin. They had a large part in the first day of the Battle of Gettysburg. He was discharged in 1864, I believe. And the reason he was discharged, it really kind of seemed like he was suffering from severe PTSD. Like, I've heard he was having nightmares. He wasn't able to eat and stuff. Like, his symptoms just really seemed like PTSD. But they didn't have a name for it. I read this book one time. It was about a French knight in, I believe, the 14th or the 15th century, and in his book, he talked about symptoms that were also, like, he saw other soldiers have it, but he experienced himself that it also seemed like PTSD. Like, he had guys, he wrote about one point they were sleeping in a camp, and someone in another part of the camp woke up screaming, yelling that the ghosts of his enemies were coming to get him. That sounds like PTSD. Like, if the people that you've killed, and remember, this is like sword combat. This is hand-to-hand combat. So, when you're fighting somebody, you are face-to-face with this man. And I think PTSD, prior to the invention of firearms, is a version of PTSD that is unlike no other. Because, I mean, like, look at today. Today, somebody could be sitting in Texas, and they could be dropping bombs on somebody in the Middle East, like 4,000 or 5,000 miles away from each other. You're never going to know anything about the people that you're dropping bombs on, other than they're there and they're a target. In the 13th century, or the 14th century, where this French knight did, you were going to see this man. You were probably going to hear his voice. You were probably, at some point, you're going to, like, feel his force against you. Like, you're going to fight him. And to take his life, it's ridiculous. Like, going back to, in the last episode, and if you missed it, the Stephen Westman interview, he bayoneted that soldier. Like, they fought for a minute. And he said he jumped in that trench, and that French soldier raised his bayonet up with him, and then it clicked with him. Stephen Westman said it clicked with him, that he was like, this guy is trying to kill me. I have to kill him first. And he talked about being sick from it. Like, he later on, even in that interview, he says that he woke up in cold sweat sometime. That is PTSD. It may not have had a name for it back then, but that is PTSD. I even read accounts of Romans, just like that French knight, Romans who talked about being visited in their dreams by the ghosts of people they kill. Yes, PTSD has always been a thing. You know, I think it's one of the reasons, and this is my personal opinion, I think the brutality of war, where you're fighting so close together, I think that's one of the reasons that, like, warfare used to have some bit of honor to it. You both understand that you were going through hell, and you just gotta have a little bit of sympathy for each other. Looking at World War II, like, on the Eastern Front, World War II, I've read accounts where frontline Russian soldiers, when they would take German POWs, they would treat them pretty well. Like, the frontline Russians would treat the German prisoners pretty well, because they have seen the combat. They know how, like, crappy this place that they're fighting in. Like, it's cold, and it's a horrible place to be fighting in. So they would treat them well. It wasn't until, like, the German POWs got to the back, where, like, the people who weren't experienced combat at all, that they started getting treated really bad, because they didn't know what was going through, so there wasn't that sympathy. I've read accounts from the Vietnam War. I read this one account. I cannot remember his name. I cannot remember the name of the book. I think it was LBJ's Hired Guns, where this American soldier was traveling through the jungle at, like, 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, and he stumbled across a Viet Cong soldier with an SKS, and they both looked at each other for a minute, and then they just nodded, and then just walked by each other. Like, if you're... that's something that you don't understand unless you were in a combat situation. Because, like I said, you were going through this hell. And you know, if I'm going through it, that guy is definitely going through it too. So you have that little bit of respect for each other in a way. So yeah. Armies have always experienced PTSD. It's a hard yes. Now, the last question for this episode is, I thought this would be a good one to end it on. It's, what is my personal favorite part of history? The reason that I study history, of course, I love the military aspect. I mean, obviously, I have a show dedicated to military personnel and things that they did. But my actual favorite thing about history is just the everyday life. Like, my number one thing that I collect is I collect newspapers. And it doesn't even necessarily have to be, like, I have a newspaper from the 60s when the Americans landed on the moon. I have newspapers from Germany from the end of World War II. I have all kinds of newspapers for these big days, but I also have a lot of newspapers just of random days, like July 15th, 2001, like whatever, you know, just random days, because I love looking through and just seeing, oh, what was going on at this time, or what was going on at this time. You know, whenever I visit monuments, or like forts or battlefields and stuff like that, I think about obviously the big things that happened there, but I also think about, like, what were the conversations that these guys had? Like, what were they thinking about? What got them through the day? What got them through this fight? You know, I think it's more important on a grand scale of things to tell the everyday life of a person more than it is to tell, like, wars and stuff that they fought in. Because if you understand how, like, a Russian peasant in the 17th century lived, then you can understand a lot more. You can understand, like, the struggles that they went through, how it can tie into today, things like that. So that's my favorite part of history. Just the regular, average, everyday person and the things that they could have gone through. But that is actually going to do it for this episode. As always, I am your host, Philip Kesterson. If you guys liked these two series, let me know. Please give me feedback. I will be glad to do this in the future. I had a lot of fun doing this. Some of these questions were really interesting. If you have a question, or like I always say, if you just want to shout out to the show and tell if you like it or if you don't like it, if you want me to just shut up forever, I can do that too. Just tell me. You can email me at above.beyondpodcast@gmail.com. Or you could pop over to the Facebook page at facebook.com/aboveandbeyondpodcast, and you can message me there. While you're there, you could like, review the show, tell your friends about it. I think that'll be all. Thank you for listening, and I will see you next week on Above and Beyond.